This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1003, a conversation with D.G. Chichester. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. This is episode 1003. It's a conversation with D.G. Chichester. It was very nice having D.G. back on the show. He was previously a guest on Comic Shenanigans about 8 years ago. So it's been a long time since he's been on the show. And we actually had something pretty modern and current to talk about. As at San Diego Comic-Con this year, they announced that there's going to be an upcoming Daredevil Black Armor miniseries coming out, which is, you know, follows in the line of a lot of these kind of legacy miniseries that we've been getting lately, set in different time periods, etc., and bringing back legacy creators and some such. So it's really nice to kind of see. And so here we got DG going back to write Daredevil, which is really exciting to a lot of people. The Daredevil Black Armor has always been one that I, you know, particularly enjoyed. I feel weird having an introing an interview with D.G. Chichester and openly calling it Black Armor, because he had very, you know, clearly stated on his last appearance on the show from September 2015 in episode 304, he had said that, you know, it wasn't armor. Stop calling it that. I mean, did say that to me, but in general, that was his thoughts. But and then when I saw this new miniseries listed, it was literally called Black Armor, and very specifically, like, was, you know, drawing upon that visual reference for, you know, DG's period of writing Daredevil near the latter bit of his run on Daredevil. I thought it was quite interesting, so I had to ask him about that and take him to task. But this was a great conversation. It was nice to talk to him about, you know, kind of what it's like coming back to Daredevil and writing another Daredevil story. And, you know, it's been obviously a while since he's written Daredevil, and what it's like to kind of get back into the swing of things. So it was very fun and enjoyable to be able to talk to him again. But again, if you do want to go back and listen to his first time on the podcast, you can check out episode 304, which is originally recorded Monday, August 31st in 2015, and then posted in September 2015. So a long time ago. Yeah, hard to believe it was 8 years ago, but yeah, we do have a previous interview you can go back and enjoy, and then you can enjoy this one. Before we get into the actual episode, I do want to mention I did get new ratings on iTunes on the US storefront. So I do want to thank ACV1968. I'll just read the quick notice here. It was a 5-star review. Welcome back. Great news on the return. Your podcast has always been top tier, and your interviewing style is outstanding. Funny thing is that in the past week, I've been listening to earlier episodes because I missed the show. Again, welcome back and bring them on. So that's very kind. Thank you so much for that very positive comment. It is nice to be back. It's nice to be talking to creators again. I'm really excited about having more and more interviews. This is the part of this is the part of the podcasting gig I really missed, was having an opportunity to talk to some people. So after this episode, next week, we're going to have an episode with Ron Friends, making his 11th appearance on the show. Very excited about that. We have upcoming episodes with Mike Carlin, legendary DC editor, as well as Marvel editor as well. He'll be on the show soon. I haven't recorded that one yet, but I'm excited about that. We have an upcoming episode that is going to have Pat Olive on the show, talking about an upcoming book he's got with Tom DeFalco. We got Kelly Thompson coming back on the show, which I'm very excited about because it's been a while since I've had a chance to talk to her. So a lot of great stuff coming up. So make sure you stay tuned. You can always email us at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, and please do rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or whatever they want to call it these days. It's always nice to, you know, to get some positive feedback, to know that you know, there is someone else on the other end of this who's actually listening to this, and it doesn't just go out into the ether and get downloaded by bots and ignored by people. So it's always nice to know that someone's listening. Anyways, thanks once again, and let's jump right into the episode as I talk to D.G. Chichester about the upcoming Daredevil Black Armor and other things about his career in comics. Enjoy. Dan, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
Thank you, Adam. I'm really good. It has been a minute, as we were just saying before the mic and the tape rolled, but it's really nice to speak to you again.
Yeah. Now, I have a professional question. Is
Yes.
In the upcoming Daredevil miniseries that we're going to talk a lot about, I'm sure, that's going to be coming out in November, are you going to be going by DG still, or are you going to go by Dan?
I have always gone by DG, except editorial credits and a couple of times where I was quote-unquote miscredited, you know, where people put Dan down. Unlike some articles that recently said that this sounds like it's something recent, that's what I've always used as my very pretentious-sounding nom de plume. So, yes, I'll continue to go by that.
Okay, and actually, people can check out your first appearance on this podcast 8 years ago, because we do talk about the origins of DG.
Yes, that eight-year flashback.
Exactly.
Search that episode out. It was a good episode, or a good conversation.
It was fun. So when this gets kind of quote-unquote announced, like kind of leaked at first at Wizard World, sorry, not Wizard World, San Diego Comic-Con, we find out that Daredevil Back in Armor is coming out. So the first thing I laughed about, and then I listened to our podcast about, and I laughed again, was that you were very ardent in that interview that it's not armor. And it's right in the title.
God bless you, Adam. God bless you. That's the deep cut. Yes, and it's not quite a running joke throughout the series, but it is acknowledged, that thought. But once you're sort of in for a dime, you're in for a dollar, as they say, or people used to say probably back in the 1930s. We are embracing it in full and I think having a good time with it.
Okay. Now, I have a lot of questions, obviously, about the origins of this project and when it first comes to. So we kind of mentioned off podcast that obviously it had been percolating for a while. What was that conversation like? Like, who reaches out to you to be like, hey, we're doing a lot of these legacy themed series right now. Would you like to come back and write Daredevil?
Well, it was actually at Terrificon, which is a nice convention in Connecticut. It's gotten some bigger reach. I had not done a convention in 20 odd years. I did one just after COVID at Terrificon. They had invited me, and then I went back for the second year last year, and I was, you know, my little table and, you know, saying hi to folks, and this very friendly looking guy like comes up, you know, puts his hand out and I said, hey, I'm Dan Chichester. And, you know, he says, oh, hey, I'm Stevie Cebulski. So my brain doesn't work very quickly. You know, it took me that 20 second of processing time. Geez, that sounds really, oh, C.B. Cebulski, editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics. So he was super gracious, very friendly, you know, said how much he'd liked the work I'd done on Daredevil. And I jokingly said, well, you know, I've been meaning to call you about those couple of pictures I've been working on. And he just said, well, as a matter of fact, and he kind of then just segued right into the fact they had been doing these nostalgia books, you know, if you want to call them that, you know, where they'd bring back some creators, putting stories back in kind of the Marvel timeline of when those might have happened. And would I be interested in doing something in that zone? And, you know, no fool I said, well, sure, I'd love to talk about it. Didn't think immediately anything of it. He was really gracious. He gave me his contact info, gave me his personal contact info, as well as his Marvel contact info. I followed up and I pinged him after the show and said, hey, we had a great chat. Just wanted to see what you were thinking about. And to his credit, boom, he got right back to me and said, yes, sorry if there was any delay. I was at Tokyo or some other show he went to right away. Not that he had to make an excuse to me. And he said, I've already talked to Devin Lewis, who's the Daredevil editor. Why don't I just have Devin call you and, you know, get in touch. And I was literally in the moment of kind of crafting a self-deprecating note to Devin to sort of introduce myself when he pinged me. So they jumped on it pretty quickly from Marvel's side of it, you know, and they had, you know, I didn't know what they wanted at that point. And when I got on the phone or the Zoom or whatever it was with Devin initially, you know, he said the first things he said, well, we really are thinking about something with the armor and with the costume from Fall from Grace. And I burst out laughing, you know, and I may have said this to you when we were talking about, you know, I never called it armor. I can't remember, but I said, and you can edit this out if this language is too raw, but I said, I said, you have no idea the amount of shit I took about, you know, for that costume over the years, which I did, you know, with, you know, I don't know if Scott McDaniel did as well, but I certainly, you know, caught enough grief from it from various people. And, but, you know, he said, that's what we're thinking, you know, it's the costume kind of got a bad rap, maybe. It's now gotten some, you know, if not outright interest, you know, it has a warm spot in people's hearts. And Hasbro had come out with this, frankly, killer toy of it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't.
As do I. And it's actually a pretty ripping toy. And it actually makes the costume look as good as Scott ever did. Like, Scott was one of the few people who could really draw it, mm-hmm. You know, with real style and verve. And I don't know if that's had anything to do with it, but, you know, this is where they wanted to go. And so we were off to the races. And this was between last July and August, these conversations are happening.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's fascinating, right? That, like, we're seeing a lot of this now where people who grew up and were reading comics in the 90s are now the people making comics more. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, what fans at the time may not have liked or appreciated, the people who grew up on it and were, you know, I forget who, many people have said over the years, you know, the best time to be reading comics is when you're 13. Like, it doesn't matter what year it is, it's just how old you are. And then that's going to be your sweet spot forever. And so, like, I'm kind of in that same spot where, you know, I would have been 13 in like 96. So I remember seeing, you know, Daredevil in the black, in that dark costume in 94. So, like, I would have been that kind of right spot. So now that we're seeing a lot of people who grew up on that stuff, grew up on Clone Saga is very in these days, and it's not
totally
not the way it used to be. So it's really interesting. If you wait long enough, these things do come back around.
It's the reverse of the Dark Knight. You know, if you wait mm-hmm. long enough, you know, the hero becomes the villain. Now the villain becomes the hero, right?
That's right.
so it reverses itself. And, you know, I mean, certainly I'm no spring chicken, as my wife would like to say. But you know, I think you're right in the sense that as I've gone back to these conventions over the last couple of years, and now I'm interacting with people more directly, or even online, you know, frankly, like, you know, yourself and other people have reached out. They are, you know, very gracious in saying, well, you're the reason I got hooked on Daredevil. You're the first issue I read was this, or mm-hmm. I really love Fall from Grace, and they're quite earnest about it, you know, that sort of thing. It does make an imprint on you. Certainly you're working with incredible characters and worlds and this sort of thing. But if you have a chance to spin out the right instances or stories with them, then maybe that makes a great connection with people. And in this instance, it's worked out nicely for me. So
was in the very early planning stages, like, obviously yeah. probably would have been maybe a long shot, but was there ever any talk about at least giving Scott a call and saying, hey, do you want to do this? Or is he too big or too difficult to bring back?
I don't know. That wasn't, you know, I didn't bring that up initially. You know, I was a little still, I guess, dumbstruck that they were talking to me in the first place. and then, you know, pretty quickly they started to float some various names of people that they were thinking about. Mm. So I got the impression that they were, you know, they were looking for some combination of maybe what I would bring to it and maybe a more modern art style or a different art style or something like that. It wasn't, you know, just necessarily a reunion tour. Obviously I would, you know, give up, well, I have to figure out what kind of body part, but a body part perhaps to work with Scott again. You know, who I think extraordinarily highly of. But I will say it's been exciting to now work with somebody new as well, mm-hmm. who is Nitho Diaz is the artist on it, and the inker is JP Mayer, you know, who's bringing a totally different look, right? My best known work is probably on Daredevil is Lee Weeks, mm-hmm. one particular style. Scott McDaniel, especially as Scott found his style, you know, in Fall from Grace, if you will. And then now seeing what Nitho is doing, which is his own thing, and his own thing with this costume, you know, as well, which is no easy suit to put on, mm-hmm. and make it work.
When you were at first, like, kind of, you know, floating the idea in your head of, like, what would I do on Daredevil, and then having it focused on the Armored Era, were you at first thinking about, you know, what it would be like to do it earlier in your run, like, kind of between the raindrops there, or were you always kind of gravitating to kind of the latter era of your run anyway?
You mean before they brought up the armor?
Yeah, before they actually kind of pigeonholed, but you know what I mean, like, gave you focus on, this is what we want, right? But, like,
yeah,
before they did that.
Yeah. Right, because when CB got back to me, you know, and said, hey, I've been talking to Devin Lewis, the Daredevil editor. We have an idea of something, mm-hmm. you know, so we'd like to go into more detail on that with you. Then I knew that their interest wasn't, you know, in me working on Night Stalkers or, you know, or you know, some fringe character, mm-hmm. or something. You know, clearly they were playing to the strength of Daredevil, which I was fine with. But, again, never in a thousand years did I really expect that. I expected more a Daredevil story. I did not expect the costume, mm-hmm. you know, to be the point of reference, just for those reasons, because the last time I played with it, it hadn't gotten a you know, real good press in certain ways. Worked for us, mm-hmm. you know, but then immediately after, you know, I was exited off the book, you know, Marvel at that time went to great trouble to literally destroy the costume, and it hasn't really been seen in circulation, you know, since, except maybe as DLC in a video game, I think, or a couple things like that.
Yeah.
So it was not my expectation. So my head was like saying, okay, well, I'll talk to these guys and we're probably going to figure out something of a, you know, Daredevil story of quote unquote ordinary Daredevil, you know, or Daredevil maybe slightly after I left the book or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, it's been, and I'm not blowing smoke, you know, probably sound like I'm blowing smoke. I don't know, but I mean, it's been, you know, it's been pretty amazing to kind of go back to this thing, even with all the problems there are going back to this thing. And problems, I mean, in a good way, because once you enter this world, I quickly realized, well, yes, now I have to re-enter a time zone for Matt Murdock and Daredevil in a very particular corner I had written myself into. Mm-hmm. Right, with the expectation that I would then be the person to get myself out of it, and get back, because at that point in time he had faked his death, he had put on this Jack Batlin persona, people, you know, so he was operating with a mask upon a mask in a way. Nobody's really interested in a story about Jack Batlin. They're interested in stories about Matt Murdock, including myself. Mm. So I had to figure out a way of, how do you play to where he is without dismissing that we're in this time zone and still make it work, and then still kind of get into the richness of Matt Murdock, the lawyer, and Daredevil, the vigilante, and play things out that way. And amazingly, I think it kind of, you know, I think it came together quite well.
That's good. I have a general question that I didn't think to jump on when we had our last conversation. Again, it's 8 years ago, so you'll forgive me from going back to it.
You.
But at the time, we had talked to, obviously, you mentioned, you know, getting, you know, let go off of Daredevil in kind of an awkward way, and that wasn't handled well. And we also talked not that long after about how you had written the crossover book with Daredevil and Batman. But I don't think I had pieced it together at the time for the timeline that you wrote that after you were fired from Daredevil. And I never really got to ask you, how weird was that for them to be like, oh, you let go off this, but then we still want you to write Daredevil in this other thing? Like, what was that like for you?
I don't think Daredevil Batman was after I was fired, because Ralph Macchio was still the editor on that.
Maybe it was just published after, because I think it was published later, but maybe you're right.
It may have been published after. But okay. I mean, I worked with Ralph on that, so that was still within that world. I was brought back, Lee and I were brought back for Daredevil 380, mm-hmm. which was the last you know, of the first volume of Daredevil before, you know, Joe Quesada and Jimmy Palmiotti, you know, relaunched it with number one as part of the whole Marvel Knights thing, right? Yeah. So that was just cool. I mean, that was just nice to be thought of that highly by the editor who was working on the book at that time to say, I want this thing to go out on a high note, and I think you guys represent that. You know, would you do this? And so for me, that was just a joy, and especially to work with Lee again.
For sure. What now, did it feel like at the time that, like, because if you look back on the history of Daredevil, it really is the end of an era when that first run ends. Like, it does feel different when it comes back with Marvel Knights, obviously, when that was by design. And then it kind of continued that to a degree even up into the modern day. So it definitely feels like there's a big demarcation line there. And so you're kind of the last exclamation point on the original era. Did it feel like you were doing that at the time? Like, did you try in how you wrote the story to, you know, be that? Or was it just, I want to do a fun Daredevil story, it's a done in one, let's have a good time?
It wasn't meant to sort of be a declaration, because the people who were taking over from it were big deals, right? Mm-hmm. You know, good people and big deals. And they were definitely going to be getting the bigger spotlight no matter what we did. But we did want it, and, you know, it's called that. It's called Just One Good Story. So what we wanted to do was just tell a really ripping Daredevil story in the style of the feeling of where we had been partners before on it. And I think that's kind of what the editor, Tim Tuohy, wanted as well. I don't think he was thrilled with a lot of what had happened in Daredevil in the in-between. And, you know, he said, I really like what you guys did, and I'd like to see that as the sort of chef's kiss, you know, end of this type of thing, you know, before it goes to its next level. And so in that sense, we just, you know, we didn't think, oh, we are going to be overly recognized for this, but it was a sense of let's do a great story. Let's do the kind of story that we do in this, and you know, a little more grounded, a little more organic, a little more Lee and Dan, you know, sort of team up, and that synergy, you know, picked right up. Once I convinced Lee to work on it, you know, that took a little doing.
So it's interesting reading it because, like, your writing is very good. What's interesting about it from the Lee Weeks perspective is that it does feel very different from, obviously, where he had been years earlier when he first did Daredevil with you. It's a little bit more cinematic, a little dark, you know, darker tones. Obviously, it's also the inker and the colorist, but it definitely makes it visually stand apart from your, you know, your initial kind of work together. Not necessarily right. In a good or a bad way, just it is distinctly visually different.
Very much. Yeah, that's a great observation. And Lee was a much different person then, much different artist, you know, much more mature artist, you know. So that's not a surprise.
So a general question about Marvel of that period, because obviously, like many who, you know, became freelancers, you know, you started an editorial and you kind of moved along, and that happened to a lot of people. What was it like? Was there a kind of fraternity of, you know, the former staff members who became freelancers and, you know, that kind of vibe amongst many of you? Because, I mean, you look at Howard Mackey, Fabian Nicieza, Glenn Greenberg, and a lot of you, you know, you started an editorial, then you started shifting into writing. Was there this kind of, and even Tim, actually, Tim Tuohy as well, because he'd written some stuff. Yeah. So was there this kind of sense of this, you know, you graduated from editorial and now you're writing and now you're all kind of working together?
A fraternity in the sense that most of us liked each other, you know, very much, and were friendly and, you know, could get along and josh and poke each other and pick up on storylines if we were involved in things without any real grief or that sort of thing. I think a lot of folks who were in editorial may have been frustrated writers or saw the opportunities in writing, you know, from that point of view as they were editors. Mm-hmm. And then that was a natural progression. Some people never want to do that, right? Some people just loved editing and were very good at editing, and they stuck with it, you know, obviously for years, you know, and would still be doing that if different things hadn't happened. And some still are, you know, to this day. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, I don't know if that answers your question. I'm not sure if, like, you were looking to sort of just get at, did we communicate or did we have a...
I'm curious what the vibe was, because you had talked in there earlier about, like, in our prior interview, you had mentioned how, you know, there was a bullpen vibe. It may not have been like, you know, the writers and artists that we had been pitched on in the mythology of the bullpen back in the 60s, but it was still, you know, there was a bullpen feel of the people who worked in editorial and what they were like working together. And there was hijinks and fun. And, like, you know, it was a fun place. I'm just curious how that translated moving forward.
Definitely. I think, you know, the fact you had worked with folks on staff and then they'd gone on to different roles and different levels of success. If you had that familiarity, and it was a kind of a lightning in a bottle time. I mean, some people say they recognize that right from the get-go or recognize that in the moment. But I think there was a good energy between people that allowed you to work easy together on staff and then afterwards as writers. And, you know, some of these people, again, going back to this thought that I hadn't been on this convention circuit in a long while, I'm seeing some of these people for the first time face to face. I mean, I've been in touch with them on Facebook or whatever, but you know, in many years, and you sort of pick right back up in the same easy way. Which I worked with people 4 years ago who I couldn't tell you their name if they were standing in front of me, and or I'd have to, like, I know mm-hmm. you somewhere. Not all of them, I mean, I think there was a real, you know, there's a good quality, and I think the quality of being in a creative environment, doing creative things, lends itself to that as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, coming into editorial in the late 80s, I mean, so forgive me if I'm wrong here in terms of my chronology at Marvel, but John Romita Sr. was still the art director at that time, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, yep. We recently lost the man, and he was a yes. titan of the industry. Do you have any particular stories of John Romita Sr. or times that you would have encountered him or worked with him?
I mean, my first job was, you know, as the assistant to the assistant editor-in-chief, you know, Jim Shooter's assistant's assistant. You know, one of my jobs was to take things around for certain signatures, you know, that needed approval. So I would circle through John's office. And, you know, he'd have to do certain cover approvals or certain cover sign-offs. And I was nervous as all get out. I was starstruck and nervous and, but he was the nicest guy. I mean, extraordinarily talented and the nicest guy and gentle and smiling all the time. All the, you know, deserved love letters, you know, you saw at his passing are all accurate. You know, he was just a incredibly talented person, a very thoughtful person, and you know, very kind. I was a little too, like I said, even as I kind of got more grounded, a little bit more grounded, you know, in myself and my abilities. I, you know, if I could go back and do regrets, I wish I could have, like, you know, gotten to know him better, tapped his knowledge base more. Mm-hmm. But all my interactions with him were always, you know, very, very pleasant. And I, you know, everybody who knows him better than I do, will validate that, you know, even deeper.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that time period, in the case of this podcast, I talked to a lot of people who worked at Marvel in the 80s and 90s. And one person I'm always interested to hear stories about is Mark Gruenwald. And obviously, as someone who worked in editorial, you would have, you know, had a lot of interactions, I would imagine, with him. Because I know he also brought, you know, kind of broke in a lot of editorial people as well in terms of teaching them the basics of editorship. What were your interactions with Mark like?
Well, I was scared of Mark, too. Sounds like I was scared of a lot of people, right? But, you know, because Mark could be very intimidating, even though he was, you know, full of you know, Loki-like, you know, spirit and energy and humor. Very, you know, out there sense of humor and big creativity as well. But I didn't know him that well initially. I sort of knew him from a distance, where he could be this sort of, like, you know, gruff character with his beard and these kind of glaring eyes and seemed like glaring eyes, because I came in through the Epic group. I worked at the Marvel side for a little bit of time, where I would take those things around for signatures, and so I'd get to know people by name, and I was still a little bit like, what am I doing here? Am I going to screw up? What's going on? And then I worked for the Epic offices, where we were a little bit separated from everybody else. And what you guys do something in Epic, right? Is it comic books? I'm not quite sure what you do. So we were a little step removed, and we had a little bit of a bigger opinion of ourselves because we were doing these higher end books and such. But as I got to know Mark a little bit more, I'll tell you the story that always will forever like be my key moment for Mark, you know, which just impresses the hell out of me to this day, which is a small story. But he had done this book, Solo Avengers, where there were like little 8-page mm-hmm. Avengers stories, I think maybe 2 or 4 to an issue. And he did it specifically because he wanted to highlight some Avengers that didn't have as much highlighting in the normal book. And he also wanted to kind of have a showcase for different talent to work on things. And so I was writing with a woman named Margaret Clark, who I did much of my early work with. And we had written this 8-page pitch for a Dr. Druid story. Dr. Druid was kind of like a druidish Doctor Strange, nowhere near as well known. Heavier, ate more bagels. I'm not sure. Whatever. but we wrote this 8-page story and we pitched it. And Mark came over to our offices because we had our offices in Epic, and he spent probably 45 minutes to an hour with these two unknowns. You know, we hadn't done anything. Going through the details of the story of what, not what was wrong per se, but what needed to be improved for him to buy it, right? So he took that time to, you know, elevate us, elevate this character in a very, you know, intelligent, you know, smart, impactful, constructive way, which to me was like amazing, right? You don't have to do this. And yet he did. And it's always something I've tried to emulate, I think, you know, when I think about how I've tried to kind of help people out in various different creative ways. I always think back to that particular, you know, moment. So he once let me kind of break into his office when his assistant wasn't there and fill his assistant's desk drawers with fish. when his assistant got back, he found the drawers filled with living, flopping fish. So, you know, that.
I mean, that's that is the two sides of the man we always hear about, so.
Exactly, right there.
Before I let you go, I feel like I haven't done enough of a good job actually getting into your upcoming Daredevil book. Because I guess one question I do have is, do you, in your mind, know exactly, like, between which issues we should be reading this, if we were going to read the chronology of this character? Like, where does this actually take place, or do you not want to spoil that yet?
I would say if there's a time, it's probably after the Tree of Knowledge storyline.
Okay.
You know, the Fall from Grace happened, then Tree of Knowledge happened. That was like 4 or 5, you know, issues that followed. It doesn't matter, though. Like, you know, like it's not tied into things that way.
Okay.
It's the way I've been framing it in my head, and I think framing it to anyone else is, imagine that a lot of other Daredevil adventures happened with this suit, with this black armor, as it says right there on the cover, that we just never saw, right? We just never knew about. Mm-hmm. We never had the lens into before. And now you do. Here's one you get to see and experience, you know, just based on the idea that it wasn't these three storylines and then, you know, somebody shredding the costume with a pair of scissors, you know, and whatever that was happening there. You know, that there were lots of adventures and lots of things going on there. And that's the way that I've approached it. And I would say to anybody who's new, who just sees the cover and sees the costume and says, that looks cool. Is that Daredevil? Let me go check it out. Or people like yourself, maybe, who remember it somewhat fondly and say, I'd like to know what else happened. You know, that's your window into this world, right?
Okay.
It's a pretty ripping Daredevil adventure. And as I said to the editors, as we kind of got into the details around the story, I said, if you'll be fair, if I'm fair to myself, the stories at that particular time with that particular costume were a bit off the leash, if you will. Maybe they were just very 90s. I don't know. So there's definitely some qualities of that in this storyline as well, like a little bit more of, you know, what starts in one place gets the dial turned up, you know, in maybe bigger, even more outrageous ways. But I think in, you know, it really comes together, I think, very well. I think it's exciting. I think it's some great character stuff. And I cannot be more impressed with the visual storytelling that I'm seeing happening with it, which mm-hmm. is a real pleasure to work with.
What's interesting, we last spoke 8 years ago. In those 8 years, I mean, when we first spoke, the Epic Collection line of Marvel trade paperbacks had really just started like a year or two earlier. And at the time, they had published Fall from Grace, which was the first Daredevil volume as part of this reprinting, you know, the first volume of Daredevil comics from issue, you know, 1 to 380. And so that was a place where people could finally get Fall from Grace and Tree of Knowledge all in one spot. Then in the intervening time, your entire run is now available in Epic Collections. Actually, incidentally, today, the last of the collections actually came out. Actually, mine arrived this morning, which has Daredevil 312 to 318. So what is it like for you to be able to now have that so nicely collected? And also, have you been hearing from people who are either experiencing it for the first time or people who've always been a fan who are now rereading it? Has anyone reached out to you about, you know, the fact that now they can actually get their hands on these stories and read them more readily?
Not so much in that way. I mean, it is cool that it's all there. For mm-hmm. a long while, I sort of felt like, what did I do wrong? Like, nothing I've done is in a collection. Like, even, you know, Last Rites Fall the Kingpin, mm-hmm. which had a collected edition, right?
It did.
Never was reprinted. Fall from Grace, right afterwards, had a really nice collected edition, never reprinted. Which I just thought was really odd. So it's been very cool to see it. And I do take a certain pride that whenever I show up in these books, I would say 8 times out of 10, like one of the titles of my story becomes the title of the, the Epic Collected Edition. Even this one is called Into the Fire, which I just laugh at because, you know, this particular one you're calling about today, like, features, you know, J.R. Jr., John Romita Jr., and Frank Miller. And yet the title of it is like this kind of throwaway story. But it's a good title. I knew how to title stories. I think, you know, certainly for me, it's just nice that they are in that kind of edition. And if I have to look stuff up, which occasionally I do, people will call me and they say, I want to talk about a podcast or, mm-hmm. A particular storyline. It's certainly easier to kind of flip back through one of those collected editions than going back and digging stuff out of storage and revisiting them as I had to do with some of this to get ready for the new series mm-hmm. was good because I did not have a very high opinion of some things, and I have a much better opinion of what I was able to accomplish. Now there's definitely some flaws and things I wish I could go back and change, but I stand behind a fair amount of it, you know, with a certain level of pride and accomplishment. Mm.
It's interesting. You mentioned, you know, you had a good sense for titles. So even, one of the Epic Collections is called Root of Evil, but that's because it's the Elektra Root of Evil miniseries. Yes. It's not even the Daredevil main book, but that's the name of the book.
Right. Yeah. They just grabbed my titles. So I was keyed into this like Steven Seagal sensibility when Steven Seagal, like, you know, mm-hmm. made good crappy movies. So.
What's interesting too, actually, when I look at the Daredevil Epic Collections, is that, you know, not every book gets reprinted, but, you know, Fall from Grace is getting its reprinting next year, which is actually surprising to me that it went 10 years without reprinting, but at least it's being reprinted. And Last Rites is already on its second printing this year, when its first one came out 3 years ago. So, I mean, there is something to that, that they're selling out enough of them that they think that it warrants going back to press. One thing I'll mention, because you mentioned that it was a weird feeling to have these books that you'd worked on just kind of disappear and not ever be reprinted. Yeah. My favorite example of that, which is so heartbreaking because it's so good, is J.M. DeMatteis's Spectacular Spider-Man run has never been collected in full. His He thinks, I've talked to him numerous times, and he says one of his best Spider-Man stories is actually not Kraven's Last Hunt, but in fact, The Child Within, and it's never been reprinted in English in Canada, or sorry, in North America. It's been published elsewhere in different languages, in like omnibus formats and all sorts of formats, but it's never been reprinted in North America. It's not even on the digital channels. It's not on Marvel Unlimited. It's not available digitally. It just doesn't exist. And it's amazing work. So I don't know what happened and why they hate that that period, but they will not. They have not reprinted it, and people are really want it because it's really good stuff. So when you talk about, it's weird that this stuff just kind of disappears for a long time. That's a weird example of someone who's high profile character, really well known and beloved story, and yet not reprinted.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear that, but hopefully, as you know, there are doing these, you know, giant size collections, and then Mark is certainly doing some of these nostalgia books on his own, you know, and I think to some success, you know, hopefully that gets remedied as well, because any of his work is always worth revisiting.
Before I let you go, any last thoughts about this upcoming series? It still makes me funny. It's called Back in Armor. I can't get over that.
It's called Black Armor.
Oh, Black Armor. I thought it was called Back in Armor.
Even better. No, Black Armor. Just strictly, let's go right for the... Adam, we're going right for the jugular. Black Armor. Like, don't make no mistake what this is about. No, it's an unexpected, treat to kind of get to play in the zone again. And I think I'm a far better writer than I was, you know, 30 years ago. But if I think folks liked what I did then, and they're going to find a lot to enjoy here. There's some fun little callbacks, not necessary ones, but if you are familiar with that world, you're going to find a few things along the way. But most importantly, I think you're just going to find that kind of brand new adventure that taps into what I think is some great things about the character. Right. Mm-hmm. There's that sense of sensing New York in a different way, experiencing New York and Hell's Kitchen, you know, like no other character does, and really playing with those dichotomies of law and lawlessness and vigilantism and standing up, you know, for somebody when nobody else is around or willing to take a stand, that this character, does it here. So I'm bullish on what people will think of it, but no matter what, I know we're doing the best work we can possibly do to make it happen.
I apologize. I have two quick questions because I just thought of them.
Please.
First one is, this one's, it feels like it could be a long question or also be short. In general, what was it like for you to kind of write a comic book again, just in terms of a comic book script is a unique thing. Was it pretty easy? Just like putting on, an old glove, or was it an adaptation you had to kind of get back into?
I think I was lucky in the sense that I've actually been working for a while on a Kickstarter project of my own. And so as part of that, over the last couple of years, actually, I've quote unquote had to write several issues of comics, you know, getting myself back into those rhythms and that sort of pacing. So having that at the ready probably made this easier to kind of get back into it, if anything. And once I was kind of off and rolling, after the initial conversations, and then we had some discussions about, well, what should we include, or should we go down this road, or, swing wide on this or stay away from that type of thing. It came very quickly. The story actually kind of came together. The bones of the story came together probably one long afternoon, I would say. and then working with the editorial office, they had some great notes and great, maybe you should do this instead. You're right. I should. And I was just testing you. Been very pleased with that experience, but that ability, it was probably made easier, as I said, by playing in that space without knowing something like this was going to come along.
Mm-hmm. And then my last question, considering how impactful that decision to go to Terrificon was, what led you to go there in the first place?
I was invited. This would have been the Terrificon after COVID, right? Not, I mean, COVID's still here, obviously, but the when things kind of opened up a little bit more. So the first Terrificon. So not what is this year? 23. So not 22, but 21.
Okay.
So I was invited by Spencer Beck, who is an artist representative, runs an outfit called the Artist Choice, who is a Philly, who knows Mitch Halleck, who runs the show well. So the two of them sort of said, hey, do you want to come? You know, and I almost didn't go, you know, like I was, well, who wants to see me, right? You know, it's been a long time. I don't have anything to sell. I have nothing to showcase. I was literally driving there that first time. And I was probably halfway there, and I almost turned around, like saying, this is ridiculous. This is just, you know, why am I going? But I pressed on, and you know, just I had a fun time. I had a fun time meeting people and exposing myself to, you know, virus probably, and, you know, lots of Purell. I had a great time. I had a great time meeting people and then seeing some folks I hadn't seen in a long, long time. And then, you know, went back last year, you know, again, as a follow up, because it was such a good experience, you know, and it was, regardless of, and with no expectation of anything, right? I wasn't going there to look for work or anything, just to kind of really meet people as I had the year before. And, you know, if they want to talk about my work, or you can make them answer their questions about storytelling or whatever. I seem to have passed the old convention times of, you know, 30 years ago, where you'd be there and somebody would come up to your table and you'd look at them really earnestly and their first words would be like, your work sucks. and you ruined Daredevil. I don't seem to get as much of that. I'm not saying I won't, but it's more people who are just interested in who are you? What are you doing here? Some are like that, which is fine. And some people have literally come up to me and said, you know, the first book I picked up was Daredevil 304, you know, and that made me love the character, that type of thing, which is like, wow, that's great. Thank you very much. I'm glad I was able to be your gateway drug, you know, to a you know, set of stories and a character that you know, meant a lot to me professionally and personally. So, you know, that was really the reason and the rationale.
Did anyone come up to you with Daredevil 305 and say, oh my God, I love the Surgeon General?
I don't know what the heck was going on with that character. I think I finally nailed it. You know, a couple of years later, I did a couple of stories for Milestone where I again returned to this ridiculous, like, evil surgeon characters. and I reread that recently because somebody wanted to talk about those issues. And I got it right. Like, Surgeon General is like a, you know, badly malformed character and a badly malformed story in some ways. But I finally got it right. So I think I got it out of my system and don't have to go back to that ever again.
Fair enough. Well, again, Dan, thank you so much for taking the time today. I'm very excited to read the upcoming Daredevil book. And maybe it means more legacy books are in your future. Who knows?
Who knows? Anything's possible. As this makes clear, but thank you, Adam, for reaching out. You know, feel free to say hi again before 8 years go by, definitely let me know what you think of the stories that starts to come out.
Will do. Thanks so much.
All right, dude. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye.